Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. I'm Susan Wall, and I'm reading August Gale by Maine author Barbara Walsh, copyright 2012 by Barbara Walsh, and published by GPP in Guilford, Connecticut. Today, we're beginning episode 13 on page 175 of this 247-page book. Episode 12 ended with Father McGettigan making the rounds of the homes of the widows, mothers, and children who had lost family in the gale. The only bodies recovered were on their way from St. Schott's to Marystown by wagon, the skipper, Paddy Walsh, and his young son, Frankie. Now, episode 13. Grinding his cigarette stub into the ground, McGettigan stepped toward Charles Hanrahan's door. He rapped softly, knowing Hanrahan's wife was waiting for him. He had seen her eyes upon him through the window, the fear tightening her face. He did not speak but a few words before Mary Hanrahan began to scream. 5 months pregnant, the woman collapsed onto the floor and drew her young daughter and son into her lap. "Your poor daddy's gone," she sobbed. The children pressed their faces to their mother's breast. Her wails terrified them, and they did not understand where their dad had gone to. His voice unsteady and barely above a whisper, the young boy turned to the priest to ask, "When will my father be coming back?" McGettigan reached for the child's hand and marked the sign of the cross over his forehead. The priest closed his eyes and recited a prayer. "May they sense your presence in this hour of need. In Jesus' name, amen." The constable followed McGettigan out the door and placed a hand on the priest's slumped shoulder. "We're near halfway done, Father." McGettigan nodded. The thought of more stunned widows soured his stomach and brought on a queasiness that left him unsteady on his feet, dizzy as if he'd been struck too many times in the head. He heard his father's advice to him as a young man, his dad shouting as McGettigan sparred in the ring with his older brother, a boxer for the British Royal Navy. "Keep your feet moving, your hands up, and keep breathing. Breathe, John, breathe." A loud buzz filled his head now, as if his brother had landed a blow to his brow. McGettigan inhaled deeply, heeding his father's words. From Reed Hill, several of Tom Reed's children spied the priest and the peculiar look on his face. McGettigan stood alongside the dirt path as if in a trance. "Why does Father McGettigan have such a queer look on his face?" they asked their mother. Jessie Reed gathered her children close. Held in a tight circle, they followed the priest's movements, as McGettigan stopped at the bottom of the knoll and knocked at their aunt's door. Jessie pressed her hand to her heart, believing her sister's adopted son had died in the gale. But then McGettigan and her sister started up the hill together. The priest, Jessie realized, had wanted her sister to come share the grim news. "Dear Lord, children," Jessie Reed screamed, "it's your dad that's gone! My poor Tom!" As dusk settled over the town, McGettigan stood before the door of the last home, the dwelling of Edward Clark, a dooryman for the Annie Anita. McGettigan waited in the dark on the doorstep. From the lamplight inside, he could see Clark's family, his 5 children and their mother, seated around the dinner table. There were sparse bits of potato, cabbage, and carrots on their plates, hot water in their mugs. Through the window pane, the priest met the gaze of a 10-year-old boy he knew as Vincent. The child stared at McGettigan with eyes that did not yet recognize his loss. The priest waited for the boy to inform his mother of his arrival. McGettigan could not knock on another door, nor could he face another weeping child. He had no more comfort to give. Chapter 24. A Final Voyage, Marystown, 2003. I learn of my grandfather's dying wish as the sun sets over the blue waters of Mortimer Bay. My father's cousin, Alan Brenton, shares the story as our car crests a hill overlooking the north side of Marystown. "He called to tell me he wanted one last ride in my boat," Alan says. "But this time," he said, "I'll be in a vase. I want my ashes scattered over Tide's Cove." At the time, in the spring of 1990, my grandfather was dying of colon cancer and had but a few months to live. He had chosen his final resting place in the inlet nearest the sea, the headlands where a lighthouse beacon had welcomed his brother Paddy home after hundreds of journeys and sails. I imagine my grandfather lying in his hospital bed, taking comfort in knowing his remains would drift in the waters where his older brother had often shouted to his crew, "We're home, boys!" My grandfather had other sentimental ties to the cove. The inlet harbored a patch of land called Big Head, a rocky crop of turf where Ambrose's great-grandfather, John Walsh, first arrived after emigrating from County Wexford. Here, in these waters, where the schooners of his grandfather and brother took refuge from the sea and a long sail, Ambrose's ashes, his physical essence, would remain. And as with his family and the Marystown fishermen who drowned in the August gale, my grandfather would forever abide in the sea. Along with desiring an ocean burial, Ambrose had another request. "Play When You and I Were Young, Maggie," he told Alan, "while my ashes are thrown overboard." Written in the late 1800s, the song had been Paddy's favorite. The skipper often sang the lyrics, off-key and loudly, at parties or alongside the family piano. The ballad told of a tragic love story between a Canadian schoolteacher and his pupil Maggie. The two fell in love and became engaged, but Maggie contracted tuberculosis. The couple was married a year before Maggie died in 1865. Their brief time together reminds me of the short time Ambrose spent with my Nana, the decade during which he fathered his first two sons. Did the song stir memories of their years together in Staten Island and Brooklyn, of his youth when he fell in love with the shy blue-eyed girl Patricia O'Connell? In his later years, when he returned to Marystown, Ambrose played the song repeatedly during his stay. "I'd come home from work and that tape was playing all the time," Alan tells us. "I don't know what it meant to him. He was always listening to it." I imagine my grandfather, alone in Alan's home, the somber lyrics wafting through the parlor with Ambrose on the couch, reflecting upon the years gone by. "They say I am feeble with age, Maggie. My steps are less sprightly than then. My face is a well-written page, Maggie, and time alone was the pen. They say we are aged and gray, Maggie, as spray by the white breakers flung. But to me you're as fair as you were, Maggie, when you and I were young. And now we are aged and gray, Maggie, and the trials of life nearly done. Let us sing of the days that are gone, Maggie, when you and I were young." Life's trials and challenges had not yet touched my grandfather when he left Marystown as a young man of 18, his hair thick and black, his face unwrinkled by time and choices that would weigh heavily on his conscience. He would not return to his birthplace for nearly 5 decades. His absence remained a mystery to his friends and family, who thought he had vanished from the earth. His mother, Cecilia, prayed nightly for him, fearing that her youngest son had gotten into some terrible trouble or was dead. And in the years after she lost Paddy to the August gale, Cecilia continued to pray that Ambrose was safe, that some terrible fate had not claimed him too. "She died, not knowing if Ambrose was alive," Alan tells us, shaking his head. "Shocking that he never wrote to his own mother, aye?" For decades, Ambrose had no contact with Marystown. He wrote no letters and made no calls, until he needed help. He phoned his sister, Donalda, in 1974, to ask her if she would allow Ambrose's son, Michael, to live with her in Marystown to avoid the Vietnam War draft. Donalda agreed to take her nephew in, but only after she hollered long and loud at her brother for disappearing without a word to his family. "My mother was furious with him," Alan says of Donalda. For all those years she had seen Granny Walsh suffer, not knowing where her boy Ambrose was to. After his lengthy absence, Ambrose accompanied his son to Marystown. It was the first of several trips he would make to his birthplace, where he would reconnect with his family and childhood friends, reminiscing about the dories he rode, the rigging he climbed, and the journeys he sailed with his brother Paddy. "Ye can take the boy out of the bay, but you can't take the bay out of the boy," Alan's son Jack would later tell me. Where did he want to be buried? Where did he want his ashes spread? All those years after he left Marystown, He never talked Staten Island or Brooklyn or San Francisco. He talked about Marystown and what it was like before he left. This was always his home. Marystown offered my grandfather a safe harbor, a haven, with few complications, few memories to remind him of his devastating decisions. Still, he carried the guilt and regrets with him. He rarely talked about leaving his first two sons and his wife Patricia, but he once confided to Brenton's wife, "Take it from my experience, people always think the grass is greener on the other side, but it isn't." In the years before his death, Ambrose found work painting hospital offices. While on the job, he met a psychiatrist with whom he shared stories about his life, the family he had abandoned. The doctor offered my grandfather some free advice. "It would be good for you to talk to your sons to resolve your feelings." Surprised at the sudden contact, my father reddened with anger when Ambrose explained, "A psychiatrist said it would be good for me to call." My father's voice rose in disbelief. "But what about us? What about Billy, Ma, and me?" Ambrose fell silent. He had no words to say. On an August afternoon in 1990, my grandfather's last wish was fulfilled. Ambrose's daughters cast his remains into the sea, while the melancholy song Maggie blared from Alan Brenton's boat. Kathy and Donnie wept as the familiar lyrics bade their father a final goodbye. "They say I'm feeble with age, Maggie. My steps are less sprightly than then. My face is a well-written page, Maggie, and time alone was the pen. They say we are aged and gray, Maggie, as spray by the white breakers flung. But to me you're as fair as you were, Maggie, when you and I were young." There wasn't a dry eye on board the boat, Alan remembers. Geez, it was some sad. My grandfather was a month shy of his 82nd birthday when he died in a California hospital in June 1990. Thousands of miles away, my father and uncle were unaware of Ambrose's illness or his death. No one had thought to inform them of their father's passing. Weeks after Ambrose's ashes were tossed into the cold Newfoundland waters, my father received a phone call from Ambrose's brother Leo with the belated news. His father, the man whom he had worshipped as a child and resented as an adult, was gone. There would be no chance for final words, no chance to mourn, to reconcile. As he hung up the phone, my dad shed his own tears, stung by a final abandonment. "My father died, and no one told me." Chapter 25. 'Tis the queerest wake. Marystown, 1935. The boy knew the bodies were coming home. Word spread quickly throughout the town, as if there were an invisible cord that connected them all. From the fishing wharves, to the kitchens, to the hayfields, to the shops, the news passed from mouth to mouth. "By God, Skipper Paddy and his son Frankie are coming home." The talk had found its way to the small ears of the boy, and the words terrified Paddy Walsh, Jr. His father and brother were not only returning to Marystown, they were coming home, to the boy's house. They were going to be laid out in his family's parlor. And the thought of all this, the idea of bodies in his home, frightened the child. In his four-year-old mind, bodies meant no heads, no arms, no legs. He didn't want to see his father and older brother Frankie this way. In the days since Father McGettigan had delivered the death notices, his mother's constant keening had shaken young Paddy, leaving the child nervous and uncertain. The priest had explained that his father and three brothers were gone, but the boy couldn't grasp the finality of what gone meant. He wanted his dad home, singing alongside the piano, his loud voice filling the room. He longed for the laughter of his older brothers, Frankie, Jerome, and James, but their bedrooms were empty and still now, and all this talk about bodies further confused Paddy. Seeking comfort, the boy ran into the kitchen, hoping to find the woman who cleaned their home and tended the garden. "Please, ma'am," Paddy pleaded, grabbing hold of the maid's dress, "look after me." Outside, dusk settled over the bay, stealing the last remnants of light from the summer sky. A few miles east, a schooner ferried Captain Paddy Walsh on his final voyage. The vessel sailed past the sights Paddy had eyed hundreds of times, the red lantern at Tide's Point, the rocky coves of Beaubois, and the green hills of Little Bay. As the schooner glided into Marystown's harbor, men, women, and children along the bay's southern and northern shores viewed the vessel as if it were an apparition. Women made the sign of the cross, whispering silent prayers. Fishermen removed their caps, still trying to reckon with the notion that Captain Paddy was dead. But ye God Almighty, Paddy Walsh, he had no fear of nothing. He could find fish better than any of 'em. Yes, boy. A crowd of men gathered at Paddy's wharf, waiting to carry the coffined bodies from the schooner. Another group huddled at the wooden gate leading to the skipper's home. Billy Mitchell stood among them, one of Marystown's heftiest residents. Mitchell's face flushed red with the exertion of walking. His fondness for salt pork and beef, "We'll be putting ye in an early grave," Mitchell's doctor had threatened. But the doctor's warning didn't concern Mitchell. Not much did. Unlike most of the men in Marystown, Mitchell didn't fish. He couldn't boast about how much salt cod he killed or how far he could row a dory. Mitchell earned his keep, making barrels at the local mill, and his passion was spinning stories. He collected details like bits of string, saving them until he settled in at a neighbor's kitchen table, where he could entertain and be rewarded in food and drink. There were few better storytellers along Newfoundland's southern shores, and Mitchell wasn't about to miss out on one of the biggest yarns of his lifetime. He knew Paddy Walsh as well as the next fellow, and was determined to see for himself if the notorious skipper was really dead. As the men carried the coffins along Paddy's wharf, Mitchell angled his way toward the larger box. Before anyone could stop him, he opened the lid. Mitchell eyed the blackened and bruised cheeks, the face bloated by death and sea. "'Tis not Paddy Walsh!" Mitchell hollered. Father McGettigan squared his shoulders and glared at Mitchell. The priest wasn't in the mood for the storyteller's theatrics. He had listened to widows and children wail and screech over the past 3 days. More difficulties he did not need. He turned to Mitchell and spoke louder than he wanted. "Don't be stirring up trouble, Mitchell. Mrs. Walsh has it hard enough without you creating stories." "You can say what you like," Mitchell answered. "But the body, 'tis Tom Reed. You're taking him to the wrong home, ye are." McGettigan shot Mitchell a final warning before he ushered the men to Paddy's fish store, the wooden shed where the skipper stored and repaired his gear. Pushing aside the nets and fish tubs, the fishermen removed the bodies from the coffins and laid them on workbenches. They took in the sight of the blocky captain and the small boy. "Jesus, you think Mitchell is right? 'Tis it Paddy or Tom Reed?" A group of local women nudged their way into the store, ushering the men from the room. "Hush now, and don't be daft with ye nonsense. We've work to do." The women blessed themselves and the bodies before they began preparations for the wake. As they removed the clothing, they noticed queer things. The initials notched in Paddy's belt buckle read T.R. His knitted wool socks and his underwear also bore the same letters. "Surely Paddy wouldn't be a-wearing Tom Reed's clothes now, would he?" they asked one another. The women weren't alone with their questions. One by one, men who had learned of Billy Mitchell's accusation entered the fish store to view the body themselves. They picked through the discarded clothes and stared at the face of a man they knew well. "Aye, boy, 'tis Tom Reed," they declared. Despite their suspicions, no one dared challenge Father McGettigan. They had witnessed the priest's wrath on Sunday mornings, the old boy pounding the pulpit, asking for more money, or chastising some fellow for cheating on his wife. And surely now didn't McGettigan have special powers? They hadn't forgotten about the only man in Marystown who had refused to help the priest build St. Gabriel's Hall. The poor lad later lost his home in a sudden fire. It could have been a queer coincidence, or it could have been an act of God, they reckoned. And there was a lot more that the Lord's servant could do, couldn't he? McGettigan, more than a few of them believed, could turn you into a goat if he so wanted. He dared not cross the priest. No, they weren't going down that path at all. Pushing their doubts aside, the women continued their task, gently washing the bodies that were now cold and heavy. They cringed when they touched Frankie's bruised limbs. Ay, the poor lad, his thin little bones took a battering. God bless ye, child. Outside in the fields and along the wharves, the rumors about Paddy's mismatched body circulated like seeds in the wind. And inside the house on the hill, the small boy listened to his mother's cries. Paddy Jr. sat in the corner of the kitchen, quietly watching his sisters and the maid scurry from one room to the next, preparing for the wake. The boy didn't understand what a wake meant, and the sudden transformation of his home bewildered the child. Dark pieces of cloth covered the mirrors. The clocks had been stilled, the window shades drawn tight. Darkness shrouded each of the three floors, shutting out the daylight and further frightening him. Paddy searched for the housemaid in the comfort of her worn apron. "Where are you, ma'am?" From the water below, fishermen shook off reluctant shudders as they sailed past Paddy's home. It was as if the building had taken on a human quality of grieving, its eyes closed, shuddering in on itself. As darkness cloaked the village, the fishermen carried the coffins up the hill and into Paddy's parlor. Lillian's screams echoed from the hall as the men placed the boxes side by side on wooden chairs. Lanterns cast shadows onto the flower-papered walls and the bodies that were now dressed in their Sunday suits. A small Bible rested on Frankie's chest. The boy's fingerprint impressions marked the book's pages, evidence, his mother believed, of her child's terror in his dying moments. Lillian would not separate the boy from the Bible he had clutched so fervently as the gale raged around him. "I want him buried with it," she told the priest. Dazed with exhaustion and shock, Lillian stood before the bodies in the room where she had served tea on silver platters, the parlor where she and Paddy had entertained guests, their laughter echoing off the mahogany ceilings. In the nearby dining room, mourners spoke in hushed voices. They did not want to upset Miss Lill. They knew she wasn't in her right mind. A circle of mothers eyed Lillian, careful to keep their words to themselves. "No, she doesn't even seem like she knows where she is, poor woman. Her eyes look right past ye, losing three sons and a husband. Ye'd never stop thinking about it, would ye? It'd be a hard chore to accept it." The lights had blazed throughout the night since McGettigan delivered this shocking news to Lillian. The neighbors heard her wail like she herself were dying. "My babies," she cried relentlessly, "they can't be gone." Now she stood before her son, Frankie, her shy, sweet boy, unnaturally still. She bent to kiss his forehead, like she had done 100 times before as he drifted off to sleep. Could he be sleeping now, she wondered. "Wake up, boy," she begged. "Please wake up, Frankie." Lillian herself had not slept since the priest came to her door. When she closed her eyes, the images appeared. Monstrous waves, walls of water crashing, sea foam spraying wildly. Schooners, dories overturned, rolling in the sea. And she saw their faces, Frankie and Jerome, their wide eyes and mouths open in screams. She imagined their terror as cold water swamped their vessels. She knew Frankie had died in the bottom of his father's schooner, but what had become of Jerome? Was he tossed from the Annie Anita, drowned after capsizing from a dory? And her eldest son, James, caught in the gale on his first journey as a skipper, where was his body? Did he try to stay with the Mary Bernice, captaining her till his last breath? And his first child, his own baby girl, born the night of his death? "This can't be real," Lillian told herself again and again. "I'll wake soon, and 'twill all be over, a tormenting dream." Lillian turned to her husband's coffin. He had always made it home, through storms, shipwrecks, and schooners trapped in ice. He had scared her plenty on his voyages, and she had counted him dead many times. But he always came home. He had tried to reassure her before he set sail. "Don't worry, Lil, if I do die and there's a way to come back to ye, I'll find it." She waited now for a sign, a voice in the night, a token that he was there. Paddy had never broken his word to her. If she wanted something, he got it for her, no matter what the price. He knew she liked fine things, fancy shoes and big houses with plush drapes and imported settees. When she had admired the grand house on the hill, one of the largest homes in Marystown, Paddy saved enough money to make it hers. She remembered the day he took her by the arm to the old Malloy Hotel with its stained glass transom, mahogany ceilings, and scrolled banister. "Do ye like it, Lil?" "Yes, of course, Patty," she told him. "Well, good," he answered, "because I just bought it for ye." Now this giant of a man was laid out before her. Could this really be Patty? Lillian had heard the whispers, the rumors, about the body favoring Tom Reed's looks more than her husband's. But surely now it was hard to tell the two of them apart in life, never mind in death. Cousins by blood, they had the same build. You could barely identify the two of them if they had their backs to you. And even their faces looked alike, with receding hairlines and wide foreheads. Lil studied her husband's body. 5 days had passed since the gale tore up the sea and broke Patty's schooner in two. His face had been battered by the ship's boards as he and Frankie sought refuge below decks in their final hours. Death had also darkened Patty's skin, mottling his cheeks black. Lil eyed Patty's chest, thick from years of rowing dories off Newfoundland's shores. She turned to his hands. Patty had always kept his fingers clean, manicured. But the hands in the coffin were rough, the fingernails caked with dirt. And Patty's wedding ring, the ring that wasn't gone off his finger since the day he was married, was missing. Lillian stepped back from the corpse. "'Tis not Patty! This is not my husband!" McGettigan's black robes rustled against the wooden floor as he coaxed Lillian from the parlor. He could see that she wasn't right. Her vacant eyes reminded McGettigan of a glass-eyed doll. The doctor's pills had calmed Lillian's nerves for a short time, but the priest knew that no amount of tranquilizers would make her forget this wretched loss. He spoke to her in a soft voice. "Meself and Patty have been friends for years, Lil. Surely I'd know Patty any time." "You're wrong," Lillian replied, her eyes focused on something only she could see. Over the next 2 days, hundreds of mourners journeyed on foot or horse and cart to pay their respects to Skipper Patty. They came from Marystown and its surrounding villages, Little Bay, Mooring Cove, Salt Pond, Fox Cove, and Beaubois. One by one they knelt and stood before the coffins. Many of them had heard the gossip, and they inspected the body to form their own opinion. They each had their own memories of Captain Patty. Bernard Butler had grown up hearing stories about the famed skipper. Fishermen measured their own catch against Mr. Patty's. "By gad, he's got so much fish," they'd lament. "Funny thing, why can't other men share his luck?" Patty lived for sailing schooners and fishing from one end of the year to the other. Aye, Bernard thought, he was a real fish killer. Bernard had tipped his cap many a time to Patty out of respect and fear. He knew you didn't mess with Skipper Patty. No, you didn't trod on Patty's shoes, no, sir. Still, Patty had a soft side. He never minded when Bernard and Patty's sons boarded his schooners, climbing to the top of the rigging. No, Bernard recalled, he never minded that at all. The sight of Skipper Patty, dead before him now, unnerved the young man. It had seemed that Mr. Patty was immortal, and now all this talk about the body being Tom Reed. Maybe Captain Patty was still alive. Bernard searched Patty's cheeks, knowing they would tell him the truth. Like other skippers, Patty often anchored his ship in Golden Bay to collect water and trap birds that flocked to Cape St. Mary's cliffs. Thousands of birds nested on the Cape's rocky crevices, and fishermen often brought home baby gulls to their children. During one of Patty's journeys, he encountered a bird that had no intention of becoming a tamed pet. The large gannet pecked Patty's face, leaving a scar on his right cheek. We'll end episode 13 right here, wondering if Bernard will see the scar on Patty's right cheek. This is August Gale by Barbara Walsh. I'm Susan Wall, and thank you for listening.